Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us for Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Rathmanner and very excited to be with you on this start of our wonderful three-day weekend. The sky is beautiful. It's wonderful weather out. It makes me very excited. How about you, Ryan?
Oh, very excited indeed, and especially today to talk about the greatest generation as we approach Memorial Day. It should be a very compelling program today.
Absolutely. I saw a great post on Facebook by someone who had just posted a picture of someone who had been in the service from their family and said, if you think that Memorial Day is all about potlucks and lakes and picnics, there's more. And I just thought, yay, we get to talk about the more today. So very, very privileged today. Well, I get the honor of reading a lot of personal stories of people who've lived through something difficult. Sometimes it's something joyful. Sometimes it's something absolutely miraculous. And I think today's story fits into that absolutely miraculous category. It's one of those stories of survival, of courage, of war, of loss, and of God's providence when death seems very near. The man who lived to tell this story is Ed Harrell. He's a retired U.S. Marine who served on the USS Indianapolis, a heavy cruiser ship in the U.S. Navy used in World War II. He was there that fateful night when torpedoes hit and sank that very large ship. In fact, it is so large that they had to be kind of surprised when those torpedoes started coming in and how quickly it must have gone down. So nearly two football fields long, that ship. Ed went into the water there. He began a 4.5-day marathon of survival with no fresh water, no food, swells of 10 to 30 feet, all in shark-infested waters. And we get to hear his story today. You'll hear that in Ed's own words about his conversations with God and about the strength of will and his faith that allowed him to survive such an ordeal. You can also read about his story in his book. I highly recommend it. It's called Out of the Depths, an unforgettable World War II story of survival, courage, and the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. And if you have a question or comment for our guest today, well, we'd love to hear from you as well. You can give us a call at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-FAITH. We'll try to get that question or comment on the air. And we also have a few of his books to give away. And so if you do call in, we'll enter your name in the drawing to get those books out to you then by the end of the show. Well, let me tell you a little bit about our guest today so we can get to his story. Edgar Harrell owned and operated the Pella Window Company in Rock Island, Illinois, for 35 years until his retirement in 1985. During the years of 1970 to 1985, he served on the board of trustees at the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, Illinois, and has been a popular Bible teacher and lay minister throughout his adult life. He currently lives in Clarksville, Tennessee, with his wife, Ola May, I believe it is, and together they're enjoying their two children, 8 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. As a survivor of the U.S. USS Indianapolis, Mr. Harrell speaks extensively around the U.S. and about his experience at sea. Ed, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so kindly. It's a delight to be with you today.
Well, thank you. I know you have a busy weekend, and everyone loves to hear your story, of course, and just I could not put your book down, and I'm sure everyone will have the same reaction if they pick it up. What inspired you to write down your story at this point?
Well, what inspired me? Well, I think I wanted to give a firsthand account of actually what happened, and then secondly, to raise the awareness of the fact that freedom costs, and we lost so many boys. The greatest tragedy at sea in the history of the U.S. Navy was the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, and my enduring those 4.5 days there in the shark-infested waters.
Hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about your background. I'd love to back up and just hear about your experience of actually joining the Navy. And how did that come about? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. Well, as an 18-year-old boy, knowing what was happening in the Pacific, I go back to Walter Winchell on our old Silvertone radio, and I was hearing that the Japs were just slaughtering many of our American boys out on those islands. And I did not want to be drafted. I thought I wanted to be a Marine. And I tell my dad, I'm going to volunteer before I'm drafted. And I go to the draft board and I tell them, I want you to call me up there in July 1943. And they obliged. And so I was called up, went to San Diego, boot camp, San Diego Marine Corps. And then from there, they said, you're going to go to sea school. Well, what's sea school? Well, I needed more education, certainly. So they put me through some 6 weeks of sea school, and then they tell me that you're going to go up to San Francisco, and you're going to catch a large combatant ship. And I go to San Francisco then, and sure enough, there was the big USS Indianapolis. And you can only imagine what a country boy, you know, would be thinking when he sees something of that magnitude. And that's going to be his home for the duration of the war.
I cannot imagine how you must have felt when you walked up to see that large of a ship. What was going through your mind? Was it exciting? Was it a little nerve-wracking?
Well, yes, maybe a combination of both, because I realized that I'd been trained, and yet I had not been trained aboard the ship, and I didn't know exactly what all would be expected of me, but I met the 39 Marines that were aboard, and they welcomed me, and realized that we had a job to do, and I wanted to be a part of it, and so we set sail just nearly immediately. After I went aboard, I was at Saipan, Tinian, Guam, Sea Battle of the Philippine Seas, where we really were in combat. Our Task Force 58, I think we shot down 403 Japanese aircraft that day. And then from there, I was down at Peleliu. I was at Iwo Jima. I was at Okinawa, 3 hour strikes on Tokyo. And lastly, I was a Marine Guard aboard the Indianapolis that picked up Fat Man and Little Boy, the components of the two atomic bombs that we would deliver to our B-29 base on the island of Tinian, and that on August the 6th and August the 9th would be dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Did you know at the time that those things were being loaded onto your ship that that is what indeed that cargo was? Or you wrote about that a little bit in your book. I'd love for you to tell that story.
No, we did not know. Every indication, even that Captain McVeigh did not know. We knew that every hour that we delayed in getting it to the forward area would cost lives. So that tells us that we've got a hot potato. And my Marine captain said, Harold, I want you to station a guard in the port hangar deck to guard that big crate. And no, he did not know what it was. And then we had two Air Force officers, proposed to be at least, that came aboard. And they had a little canister in a metal cage with a padlock on it. And a couple of sailors put a rod in that and put it on their shoulders and took it up to the forward air. And there again, my captain said, Harold, station a guard on the outside of the hatch there. Well, what? What do they have, Captain Parks? He said, we don't know. Well, may I get ahead of the story and say they were not Air Force officers. They were scientists from Los Alamos, New Mexico. And what they had in that little canister was half of the uranium that America owned at that time. We did not know who they were nor what they were transporting either. We find out later, much later.
Wow, that is amazing. We have to take a quick break, Ed, but we are going to come back and hear more of Ed's story. Of course, those days when he was lost at sea. And also, we'd love to have you call in, get a copy of his book. If you so choose, you can give us a call at 877-933-2484. Love being able to honor all veterans by just hearing this story and about God's provision during this time of need. So we'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
it's encouragement and hope for your daily journey.
I think life is difficult enough, and it's really good when your day is going wrong or when your day is going right that you can either rejoice with what you're listening to or hold on to what you're listening to. And I have two small children, and it makes a difference to them. It changes my day, and it changes my life, and it strengthens my walk with the Lord, and I want to show and model that to my children.
Connecting your faith to your everyday life. Thanks for growing with us on Faith Radio.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Why do you listen to this ministry? One listener wrote and said this: I have a belief that how you and I make people feel is what they remember. Your programs make me feel like I can rise up above life's challenges. I'm encouraged, challenged, strengthened, and hungry for more. Stories like these are possible because of your friendship, prayers, and generous support. You can give simply and safely online at myfaithradio.com. Thank you.
Connecting Faith, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Joe Rathmanner, and today I have the honor of speaking to a survivor of the USS Indianapolis, Mr. Ed Harrell. Ed speaks extensively across the United States about his experience at sea and has also written a book called Out of the Depths, an unforgettable World War II story of survival, courage, and the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. Ed, I'd love if you would take us to that fateful day when the Indianapolis was sunk. You had engaged in active combat, your ship had been all over, and now you're back out to sea. Tell me about that night when you encountered a Japanese submarine.
Well, it was on the night of July the 29th, but it had just turned the 30th, and I was on guard duty that particular night. I got off a watch at 12 o'clock, and since it was miserably hot that day, maybe 110 degrees, and we have no air conditioning aboard ship, and we were permitted to slow down and travel at about 17 knots. And the good captain would say, since it's so miserably hot below deck, you're welcome to come topside and make your pallet out on the open deck anywhere. So when I got off a watch, I go down to the marine compartment and I got my my blanket. I did not get my Kapok life jacket. Don't need that. And I go back topside, go all the way forward. When I say all the way forward, the big 8-inch gun, number one turret, all the way forward, I made my pallet right down on the deck under the barrels of that and kind of put my blanket over my head a little bit. And I used the arch of my shoe for a pillow. And anyway, I just maybe begun to at least relax and nearly doze off to sleep. And all of a sudden, a massive explosion. And when I say massive, the first torpedo cut the bow of the ship off. And when I say cut it off, it wasn't there. About 35, 40 feet of the bow of the ship was cut off. And then the second torpedo, no doubt, was back close to the marine compartment, but no one lived to tell anything about that. And then the third explosion was a magazine under number two turret. And it exploded and went through the top of the turret and multiple explosions below deck then. Well, immediately I knew that the ship was doomed because just visualize that we are about three decks deep there at the bow of the ship. There were three compartments, top one, two, three, up and down. And we become a funnel. We're moving forward, and all that water is coming in, being forced in, and I could hear the bulkheads breaking below, and I realized that I've got to get to my emergency station, which was back midship, and so I don't know whether I had my blanket or whether I got my shoes. I've tried to remember that, but anyway, I'm making my way. I still have my clothing on. I went to bed that night in my dungaree jackets and my trousers and all. And so I start back to my emergency station, but there were those coming out of the forward area, and most of that was officers' quarters. And as they were coming out on the open deck, you could see that they were just in their night clothing, just a pair of skivvies mostly. And they had been flash burned and maybe touched a bulkhead with their hand and left the skin or the hand on the bulkhead. And they were pleading for someone to give them some assistance, but that's not my responsibility and really nothing that I knew to do. And I'm making my way to the quarterdeck. I knew my Marine lieutenant would be there to give me instructions as to what I'm to do. And yet before I get there, I could realize that the bow, the ship is going under. And when I get to the quarterdeck, then realizing I don't have a life jacket. My life jacket is down in the Marine compartment. But when I get to the quarterdeck, Lieutenant Stauffer was there, and I said, Lieutenant Stauffer, permission to cut down those canvas bags of KPOC life jackets. And his response was, not until we get word to abandon ship. Well, the ship is sinking. I just came from the forward area, and I know that even now the bow is already nearly submerged. And then there was a Navy commander that came from below deck, and as he came through the hatch, I recognized him, but he was nearly beyond recognition from the flash burn and all, and some sailors said, get the commander a life jacket, and they began to cut some of those KPOC jackets down, and I managed then to get me a KPOC life jacket, and I put it on, and I tell people that wouldn't know what a KPOC life jacket is, just imagine a horse collar made into a vest, and I put that on, but I don't fast it in the straddle because I know that soon, very soon, I'm going to be leaving this ship.
What was going through your mind at this point? I know you tell just a harrowing story in your book about hanging on to a railing and praying before you headed into the water. What was it that you were thinking? I know a lot of people, you wrote, some people call out to God, but some people call out to God, and there's a difference. Tell me more about that.
Okay. Finally, word trickled down that the good captain had given word to abandon ship, and I made my way over what we call the rail there on the port side. Now, on the starboard side, normally we would be 8 feet above a water line, but there's water on the quarterdeck, so we were really on a slant. And I made my way over to that rail, and many others were with me, and many of them were climbing over that rail, jumping into the water. And I held onto that rail, looking out into the blackness of the night and realizing that I thought, this could be the end of life. Life is over. And then everything flashes back home, you know, mom, dad, brothers, six brothers, older and a younger sister, and a certain brunette that said that she would wait for me, and I'll have to get ahead of the store and say, and she waited. We were married in 47, and just this past year, we celebrated our 66, and another few weeks now, July the 25th, will be our 67th wedding anniversary. I had something to live for, and I grabbed a hold of that rail, and I prayed. I say oftentimes, there's times when you pray and there's times when you pray. And I was praying. I was desperate. I needed to know somehow, some way that I have some assurance that I'm going to make it. And as I prayed, I no doubt promised the Lord many things. But I tell him, I don't want to die. I want to live. And I want to live for you. And then I had just a verse of scripture that came to mind that I have to think that the Lord just put it in my mind. Now, I knew of the scripture, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. Peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your hearts be troubled. Don't be afraid. And with the assurance somewhat from his word that I'm going to make it, I stepped over that rail. And I made two big long jumps down the keel of the ship into the water. I went in feet first, and my KPOC jacket then came up over my head, and I saw all of that oil on the water. I knew I had to get my head above that oil, and so I came up with my hands to get myself my head above the oil and then to swim away and to see other buddies already out there. Looking back and seeing now the bow, the ship is completely under. The fantail begins to come high in the air. And I was seeing boys actually jumping from up high like that. They're looking down in the blackness of the sea below. They couldn't see those big screws still turning. Some boys actually jumped into those screws. Many others said that they likewise saw boys jump into the screws, but I saw the ship as she rolled to the starboard and nosed down, and she went completely under. And now we begin to take inventory of the little group that I was in, and we detected that maybe there's about 80 of us. And I wanted to know offhand, firsthand, any Marines? And finally, yes, there were two other Marines. One had gone into the water head first, and maybe I'll get back to him later, but my buddy Spooner. And the other Marine was a new Marine that had just come aboard, maybe in Frisco or even in Guam. And I saw him, and I knew he was a new boy that came aboard, but did not know his name. I could see his face, but I saw him as I tried to help him, but he had been blown against the bulkhead. He had multiple breaks, no doubt, in his body. And actually, I'm holding him for the next hour, but finally, he passed on from this life.
Mm. So to give us some perspective, there were nearly 1,200 crew members on board when you started, correct?
Right. There was 1,196 plus a passenger aboard. And we surmised that maybe 900 of us actually got off the ship. But at the end of 4.5 days, there were only 317 of the total number still alive to be rescued.
So that night, you glommed on to around 80 people. And so did you think that was all that was left, or did you surmise that there may be some other groups on the other side of the ship, or how, what was going through your mind at that point?
Well, you were concerned. No, I didn't know how many had gotten off or from what part of the ship. Now, again, the ship is, you know, 610 feet or so long. So boys were getting off at different intervals, and the ship is still moving somewhat in the water, slowing down all the time. But, of course, you could hear voices, hear screams, hear hollers, and so on. And but we had problems with our own group in that several did not have life jackets. Several were injured, and so they're needing assistance, and some that didn't have life jackets, they're hanging on to a buddy. And those who were injured, you know, someone was trying to take care of them, and many of those, at least I would say a half a dozen or more, passed on this life before daybreak. And many of those, of course, that didn't have life jackets, they're maybe hanging on to someone else, and after someone has expired, especially the next day when we could see someone has already passed on from this life, you know, we could remove his life jacket. And the one that did not have one, now he has at least a makeshift of a life jacket.
So this is the middle of the night. Tell me about the water temperature at this point.
Okay, the water temperature is about 85 degrees, and 85-degree water is not bad at all. The only thing, you just get out into an 85-degree weather and get soaking wet, and then a little breeze comes up, and you begin to chill. And it isn't long until, you know, you just shake. Well, if you don't have on much clothing to keep your body temperature in, you're going to get hypothermia. Well, maybe not at 85, but it isn't long until that 90, you know, that 90-plus temperature that you had, it's going to succumb down to whatever the conditions are around you. And if it gets down to that 84 degrees, you know, hypothermia sets in, and there's no recovering from that. And many of them experienced that, and we saw them pass on into eternity.
We're listening today to Ed Harrell. He's a retired U.S. Marine who served on the USS Indianapolis in World War II. It's a heavy cruiser ship in the U.S. Navy. He was there that fateful night when torpedoes hit and sank that ship nearly 2 football fields long and went into the water, and there began a 4.5-day journey of survival. With no food or water and shark-infested waters, we're going to hear more about that coming up after the break. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and Ed has written a great book on this story. And it is called Out of the Depths, an unforgettable World War II story of survival, courage, and the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. We do have a few copies. We'd love to get that in your hands. If you're interested, give us a call at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Rathmanner. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're trying to honor our nation's veterans by hearing an incredible story by Ed Harrell. Ed wrote a book called Out of the Depths, an unforgettable World War II story of survival, courage, and the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. We've been listening to Ed's story leading up to the sinking of that ship, and now, of course, the most difficult part, I think, of the story is surviving in those 4.5 days in the cold water and in the horrible heat. Ed, we were talking a little bit about the temperature of the water during the night, but during the day, it was really hot, right?
Yes, in the daytime, it's 100 to 110 degrees, and of course, we're bareheaded, and we're swimming nearly constantly. You're nearly having to swim to stay together. And the first day, of course, we have sharks, and you hear a blood-curdling scream, and you look, and you see that capon go under, and then like a fish cork, it comes back to the surface, and you see many, many, many fins around all the blood. You dare not to go and check to see who your buddy might be. It's sometime later, though, you check, and you find out that maybe the bottom torso is gone, or he's been disemboweled, or a leg or something is gone. Now, I'm going to move on to maybe the second day. By the second day, we've lost many, many boys, and it is still hot, and you're exhausted. Your lips are swollen. They're cracked open and bleeding, and you're in all of that oil and all of that salt water, and then your tongue begins to swell in your mouth because of dehydration and you are so thirsty, and you dare not to drink the salt water because you see boys who would dare to tear off some of their clothing and put a little water up in a strainer cloth and hold their head under there and drink some of the salt water. And within the hour, you see what's taking place. That goes to their brain, and they do not know straight up. They don't know whether you are a friend or a foe. And they can just imagine all kinds of things. But it was sometime that second day when we are so thirsty, knowing that we cannot make it unless we get some water. And then we have a little rain cloud coming over. We see it. Look, it's raining. It's raining. And then after a little bit of time here, this little cloud came over and dropping much, much water. Well, what do? You open your mouth heavenward, and you get maybe a few tablespoons full of water, but it's washed off of your face. That oil that's all over you, it's down over your lips, and you swallow that, and you get some oil in with that, and then that gets in your system, and then you regurgitate to kind of upchuck some of that, but you need all of that moisture, but at least you got some water. Now I'm going to move on through the next night and into the third day. Now we've been losing boys, various reasons. Many have been injured aboard ship. Many of them could not make it through the next days. But the third day at noon, there's only 17 of us left. So you can just use your own imagination as to what all has taken place. And when there was just the 17 of us, we were talking. We see planes flying over 30,000 feet. There are B-29s bombing Tokyo, but no one's looking for us. And we're saying, you know, unless help comes, unless we get close enough to the Philippines and someone spots us, we aren't going to make it. And then you see buddies all around you that have been disemboweled, and their bodies now on the third day, and they've been dead now, you know, for 3 days, and their body is just disintegrating. You look at the face of one, and you can hardly tell, you know, he's human, and then that flesh is coming off, and maybe he's up on the upper part of a 8-foot swell, and all of a sudden that swell breaks, and that body comes down and slams against you, and the residue from the face or from the other parts of the body is deposited on you. And how do you get rid of that? I might say you don't, but we lose boys. We were losing boys. But the third day at noon, we said, everyone prayed off and say, there's no such thing as an atheist in foxholes. And there were no atheists out there. Everyone prayed. They may not have known to whom they were praying, but they prayed. God, if you're out there, I don't want to die. I've got a son back home that I've never seen. And then he couldn't finish his prayer because of just crying his heart out. And yet others prayed. And some of us would kind of take charge and lead in a good verbal prayer, and after a period of time, we came up on a swell, and we said, look, look, there's a raft, and it was a raft out a couple of hundred yards or so, and we would holler at them, and they responded back to us in English. It's some of our buddies, and it isn't long till we make our way a little closer to them, and we join up with them, and when we saw that raft, we saw that no one was on the raft. There were five sailors hanging on to that raft just all around it. And when they came into our group, we saw what was on the raft. Even by now, our capon jackets were gone. That is, they wouldn't hold our heads out of the water. So we turned them upside down. We were seated in them. But here, that little raft came in, and what was on that raft was capon life jackets that they'd taken off a boy's already expired and squeezed them out and put them up in that 100-degree sun, and they joined our group, and we got a spare tire from them, and they said, anyone want to join us? We've got to get close enough to the Philippines that someone will see us. And I say to my Marine buddy Spooner, Spooner, I'm going to go with them. And he said, Harold, if you go, I'm going with you. So two Marines joined five sailors, and now we think that we're going to swim to the Philippines. And we didn't know it was another 500 miles, but when you see a group of 80 go down to 17, there's time to do something. And so here we start. Sometime later that afternoon, though, we came up on a swell, and I said, look out there. There's just an old crate or something out there. And I said, I'm going to go out and get it. And I was warned not to, that the sharks might get us. But I said, no, they haven't bothered us, haven't been around us now for a while. I'm going to go out and see what that might be. And as I got closer and closer to that little crate, I'm praying, Lord, we have to have food. We have to have water, or we aren't going to make it. And then, lo and behold, I see those potatoes floating in that crate, and I grabbed a hold of that first potato, but kind of in the agony of defeat, it was rotten, and as I squeezed it, that rot squeezed between my fingers, and I thought, oh, rotten potatoes, but I took my hands and peeled it some, because it was hard on the inside, but just rotten on the outside, and I peeled it with my hands, and then I peeled it with my teeth, and I didn't spit out all the rot. So we had a little bit of potatoes there, and my buddies saw me. They said, what is it? Rotten potatoes. But they leave the raft, and they came out and joined me. We had a little bit of water in that little bit of potatoes and a little bit of food. I'm going to yield, and then I'm going to come back to the next day, the big day.
Mm. Well, you write so often in your book just about how God continued to provide these things that you didn't necessarily ask for, but you knew somehow that he was going to provide. I'm just going to read a short little snippet from your book and then have you respond. This is called Prayer Meeting at Sea. It says, although my understanding of spiritual issues was immature and my faith was largely untested as a young man, I still possessed an unwavering assurance that I would be saved, both physically and spiritually. I did not fully understand it at the time, but my confidence emanated from the Holy Spirit within me. Did you did you feel inside of you, how did you understand that this was actually going to happen, that he was going to provide for you?
Well, when I prayed and I received just that verse of scripture, peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth, give unto you, let not your heart be troubled. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. I can't say I was never afraid. I was scared to death, but I believe that somehow, some way that the Lord laid on my mind the fact that he was in charge and that I would make it. And so when I experienced that rain shower that second day and then that that raft the third day, and then sometime later that afternoon the potatoes, and then even on through that night we lost boys, because you can only endure so long. And then other groups came into our group, a Navy lieutenant that I knew and a sailor or two came into that group. And I come to the fourth day now. I find myself not with the raft, not with my buddy Spooner, but with Navy Lieutenant Charles McKissick and one other sailor. And I saw the other sailor doing what I had seen so many times. And I often say, it's much easier to die than it is to live. Mm. And I saw that he was just willing to give up. And his head had dropped into the water. And I go over and I shook him. He's still alive. And he responded. And then a few minutes later, the same thing again. And I roused him up. The third time, it was too late. So it's just McKissick and myself. And then after a period of time, now we are seated in our capon jackets again, because we can't just swim constantly, but by putting that capon under us, and we have to keep ourselves erect, but it has a little more buoyancy in its ability down under us. And then all of a sudden, I hear a plane. I hear a plane. Look, look, I see a plane. Well, here's a plane flying maybe 3,000 or 4,000 feet, and we could see at the twin engine, see that it has wheels on it, so he can't land. But we're waving, we're splashing water, we're hollering at him, everything in the world to attract his attention. But, you know, if he knew we were down there, impossible for him to see us. You see, he's flying, say, at 3,000 or 4,000 feet. He's looking farther to him, let's say, 4 mile. He's looking out his peripheral vision, say, 2.5 mile each side. And so he's looking at 20 square mile. And to see a man's head down here are 6 to 8 inches, impossible. But in the providence of God, you know, God made it possible for him to see us. Here's what was happening up above. Lieutenant Gwynn flying that Ventura, he was having trouble with his radio antenna. He couldn't reach back his base down in Petaluma. And he says to the co-pilot, that stabilizer on that antenna has come off. Take over controls. I'm going to go aft, and I'm going to pull that in and put a stabilizer on it, or we can't reach base. And as he goes aft and he opens the bomb bay door, he glances down just a split second, and what he saw was the oil on the water down below. And when he saw that, in his mind, that meant that maybe there's a Jap sub down there. And so what does he do? He takes over control of the aircraft, and the crew says, what is it? They knew that he saw something. He says, look down there. Well, all they could see maybe was just a little oil slick, and I like to think it was the Boy Scouts mirror, the sun hitting that oil, you know, that flash of that told him that maybe there's a Jap sub down there. So what does he do? He takes over control. He gets on the speaker and he says, load the bombs, load the bombs. and they loaded the bombs, and they're coming in on a bomb and run. We see him. We say, thank you, Lord. Thank you. Look, look, he's coming in. And as he came down, then he began to see more sharks than he saw boys. And he came down, and I can see him today as he came down, and as he circled us three or four times, I can see his visage today in that cockpit as he circled us and as he tilted his wings, saying, I see you. I know that you're down there. And then I see him going up much higher. I wondered, well, why is he going up there? Some years later, I asked him, why did you come down and circle us and go back up? He said, I could not reach out with my radio until I went back up 4,000 feet or so. And then he called down at Peleliu to announce, ducks on the pond. Now, whose are they? No one knew. But he got a hold of a pilot of a PBY, Lieutenant Adrian Marks, and tells him of our coordinates out there. And an hour and a half later, 150 miles or so later, Lieutenant Marks comes on the scene, and likewise, he sees boys scattered everywhere. He sees sharks attacking boys, and he asks permission to do a no-no, and that was to do an open sea landing in a PBY, and they tell him no way. But he and the crew says, we have to go down and help some of those boys down there. And so he hung up the phone basically on his command in Peleliu, and he set that big goose down. And he hit that first big swell, and it went up in the air, and he conked out a motor. He ruptured the pontoon, but he set that big goose down, and then he began to pick up stragglers. And after a period of time, he picked up 56 passengers, of which I'm one of those 56.
Amazing story, Ed. Just amazing. We are going to take just a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to hear about those first thoughts that you had when you were finally safe. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith.
It's a place in your radio dial for hope.
Paul was able to say, after talking about his thorn in the flesh, which many believe was actually a physical disability, he said, his strength is made perfect in weakness. So most gladly, therefore, will I rejoice in these weaknesses, for when I am weak, then I am strong. The words of a man that learned that God comes near in times of hardship.
Meeting you at the intersection of faith and life, every day, Faith Radio.
I was a very busy woman with a dream. Someday go back and continue my education and maybe even hopefully finish my degree. But you know, life just has a way of happening. Marriage, kids, work. And then I heard about the graduate and continuing education program at the University of Northwestern, St. Paul. I could attend accelerated courses in a Christ-centered, caring environment. They helped turn my dream into a reality.
Reserve your place at Information Night on June 9th at unwsp.edu. Plus, enter to win a $1,000 scholarship.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're talking to World War II survivor Ed Harrell. Ed was on the USS Indianapolis when it was sunk by a Japanese submarine, and he's been telling his harrowing story of survival at 4.5 days at sea. Ed, once that plane landed and picked up those 56 people who were out at sea, what was going through your mind when you first felt like you were safe?
Well, I was so happy that the Lord saw fit to spare me through all of that. And then, of course, I get aboard the plane, and they stack us in there like a sack of feed. And I'd been in the plane a little bit, and I look over, and I see a USMC on a boy, and I could see that's my buddy Spooner. And I saw what Spooner was doing. He had a can of green beans, and he was hacking down on the deck of the aircraft to find a little stud bolt or something to knock a hole in that can of beans, and drinking some of the bean juice. And I said, hey, Marine, how about some of your bean juice? Well, you'd have to know Spooner, but he kind of told me where I could get off. And I said, Spooner, you don't know who this is. This is Harold. Well, I happened to be his squad leader, and I didn't tell this, but on the second day, he was going to commit suicide, and I fastened him onto me, and I swam together with him through that rest of that second day and through the night before the third day. And now I'm picked up by the aircraft. The USS Doyle destroyer is on the scene by now. We're transferred aboard the Doyle, and then we're taken to Palau to the hospital. And then that was the closest one. And then a few days later, we're in Guam in Base Hospital 18. And most of us are just bedfast in that we have injuries. We have where you're anything that would rub against your flesh and irritate it, then that oil and that salt cause the salt water ulcers. And after a day or two, that is just rotten flesh. And try to clean that off. You know, you clean into the quick, and then you start bleeding. So anyway, I'm in the hospital in Guam for a good period of time. And then we finally get back to the States October the 2nd, July the 30th. Now, October the 2nd, I've been in the hospital all of this time. Get back to the States, Marine Corps base. I think that I'm coming home for a 90-day leave, but on October the 4th, I end up in Balboa Hospital. I have a perforated appendix, and my white blood count was of such that they said, we can't operate. Can't operate, no. And the penicillin was new, so I became a pincushion. 29 days later, they'd given me 11,800,000 units of penicillin. I'm still in the hospital, though, through Thanksgiving, through Christmas, through New Year's, I think, sometime after January, maybe January the 16th, I finally managed to get out of the hospital and go to Marine Corps Base to be ushered out and ushered home.
Well, I can't end the show without you telling me about your reunion with that, I think you called her a brown-haired girl, right?
Without what? I didn't get you.
Without your reunion with the girl who said she'd wait for you. So can you tell us a little
okay,
bit about that
well,
reunion?
I came home, and yeah, she was waiting, and we were married in 1947, and we have had two children, a son first, then a daughter. And my son is my pastor today, and I have grandkids and great-grandkids, and I look at them every day, and I look up and I say, thank you, Lord. I would not be here today if it were not for your providence. There would be no son or daughter, no grandkids, no great-grandkids. So I have so much to be thankful for, and there's not many hours that pass that I don't just look up and look back at life and say, thank you, Lord, for your providence, for your mercy and your grace, for this 89-year-old World War II Marine still up and on the go today, telling of God's mercy and grace and his providence in my life back then and, yes, even today.
Well, as we approach Memorial Day, Ed, how is it that we can pray for veterans?
Well, I think America needs to get back to where we were back when I was a youngster growing up, and show respect to our servicemen that are still in combat today and that are walking the streets, and many of them are back injured. And I have the opportunity to come up, I believe it's the 5th of next month, to go to a battalion of servicemen that have been injured physically, mentally, et cetera. And I have the opportunity to go and to share my story with them. And I would like to think that we today, we have slipped away from our love for our country and for our fellow men and for the freedom that we once had, and that we need to get back. We need to get back to God, frankly.
Ed, that is just such a great way to end the story, this book, the show, this book, this story. It's just a wonderful tribute to what the Lord has done in your life and what he can do in the lives of others. So thank you so much for writing it and for sharing that with us today, Ed.
Fine. Thank you so kindly.
Absolutely. Well, as we close our show today, we're going to end with a song that seems fitting for today. It's written by Michael W. Smith. It's called There She Stands, just about the flag and how veterans have made it possible for that flag to stand for all of us. Have a blessed day.
Faithful friend, shimmering stars, westward wind, show the way, carry me to the place. Stands. Just when you think it might be over, just when you think the fire is gone, someone will risk his life to raise you. There she stands. By the dawn.